It's been interesting as we have been back on our furlough. One of our mentors told us, as you come back to the States, you guys, you're going to need to beware of two J's. One is judgmentalism. The other is jealousy. And I was like, okay, interesting. Well, I got back and I'm like, okay, let's remember this. And sure enough, these two J's have been like the way I have felt life moving for the past. We've been here since August, middle of August. Seeing yourself at one time saying, you know, Americans just are, they have so much stuff. And then I go across the other side and say, I need that stuff. Right now, there is so much that's vying for your heart in this season. This Advent season is a season of, historically in the church, it's been a season actually of fasting and waiting. A season of letting go and being like the Simeon and the Anna, who are looking, longing, passionately seeking the consolation of Israel. And yet there is every other company out there that is trying to get your heart and your mind off of that very thing. I want to read you a very interesting little example of that. Because right now, if any of you have your smartphone in your hand, there's no telling what could pop up on the screen during these next 30 minutes or so, seeking to get your mind off of the voice of God. Listen to this. Digital marketing experts estimate that most Americans are exposed to around 4,000 to 10,000 advertisements each day. The author writes, like many, I thought that that number sounded a little far-fetched, so I actually decided to dedicate one entire day to test it myself. I asked my wife and anyone I thought I would come in contact with to not distract me too much. I wanted to pay keen attention to the direct and indirect advertising impressions I was exposed to. On my test day, I woke up in the morning to my Sony radio alarm clock, heard about 14 ads on my local station, KTTS, before I opened my eyes and hit the snooze on my Sony clock. I used my Panasonic TV and Dish Network receiver remote, noticed a Kenwood receiver and a Toshiba DVD player, and watched and listened to 46 TV commercials as I got going. Standing at my sink, I turned on my Moen faucet, grabbed my Arm & Hammer toothpaste, a Crest toothbrush and Pearl Drops, my Menem shaving cream, my Schick razor and Right Guard deodorant. I count 51 product labels within eyesight in my medicine cabinet and 47 other labels just standing in our bathroom while looking around. I'm up to around 200 ads, and my hair isn't even combed yet. I got dressed in my Fruit of the Loom undershirt, Big Dog shirt, Wrangler jeans, and Nike shoes. 11 brand advertisements are within eyesight in the closet. I'm not digging for them. I opened my pantry and counted 214 food brand labels, all colorful and professionally created. I get my box of Kellogg's for my Jersey made milk, and count 62 product brands. I open a can of Folgers coffee to brew in my coffee maker. I've gotten around 487 ad exposures, and I haven't even finished breakfast. I ended my experiment here. I was brand weary and knew the exposures would become even more frequent when I stepped out of my front door, concluding that they were probably telling the truth. You feel this? Do you feel this? Some of you do. Some of you right now, how many of you have actually made a purchase online since Black Friday? Anybody make an online purchase of anything for Christmas since Cyber Monday, Black Friday? Look at that. Almost all of us, right? It's kind of the thing we do. So let's just look at a few of those advertisements here on the screen and just think about some of the messages that are trying to be conveyed by some of these ads. They're simple, but let's just say, hopefully some of you have found already the perfect coat, because it is possible to find not only that, but also you can find the perfect fit. How many of you have found it so far? I thought Brad did. I thought I saw that. And, you know, you hear this and we laugh. And yet there's something subtle there. It's a quest for perfection. It's a quest for something perfect, not lacking. Moving on, if it's not perfect, then it's essential. Some of you probably haven't yet gotten the essential outerwear that you need. How many of you are still thinking about getting that essential piece? Yeah? Or if it's not that, it's just you don't want to miss out. How many of you know what FOMO means? F-O-M-O, fear of missing out, right? So you've got to be getting the latest news that, oh, we've extended our 50% off one more day. Guys, I don't know if you've got the best winter pants, but you probably should consider that what you're wearing right now is not enough. And you know that happy is trending at this hashtag? I feel it. Do you feel it? Let's go to some cars for those of you that care more about cars and clothes. You know, right here, this is going to set you apart. The Honda New Accord, sophistication does come standard, but if you bump it up just a notch, you actually stand out from the crowd. And that actually is what we hope will happen with each of us, right? We hope that we'll not be just plain and like the other guy. We do want to stand out. So if you can afford that, then you can do that, or you can do it in other small ways. For you moms, this is the one and only Swagger Wagon. It's the 2017 Sienna, and that's going to give you an opportunity to make a name for yourself as well, in a subtle way, the Swagger Wagon. But wait, there's something more that you probably haven't gotten yet, and that's going to the next level of entertainment. You need the SUHD TV. Some of you maybe have already gotten this. If you have, we'd love to talk after the service to see if, in fact, it is the ultimate viewing experience. We hope it is. But for some of you moms out there who don't care about that, you really would like to get something like this refrigerator from Samsung. And one that I don't have pictured here that can take a picture of what's inside and send it to your phone. So you'll never be without knowing what's in your refrigerator. You need ultimate versatility. For you Mackies, you can just take a touch of genius because that's going to set you apart. And you're going to get that, and it's going to change your world for the next couple years until you get a new one. And if you can't find the right gift, just go to Bed Bath & Beyond, and a gift card is always the perfect gift. Now, we laugh at that, but what's happening is there is so much right now that's pulling you to imagine that paradise can be experienced now. Listen to what Paul David Tripp says. It is sad how many people constantly live in the schizophrenic craziness of eternity amnesia. Eternity amnesia. Amnesia, of course, is the state often associated with excessive drunkenness where you completely forget a portion of your knowledge. But he says, how many of us live in the schizophrenic craziness of eternity, amnesia? We were created to live in a forever relationship with a forever God forever. We were designed to live based on a long view of life. We were made to live with one eye on now and one eye on eternity. You and I simply cannot live as we were put together to live without forever. But so many people try. They put all their hopes and dreams in the right here, right now situations, locations, possessions, positions, and people of their daily lives. They load moment after moment with undeliverable expectations. They ask people to be what people this side of eternity will never be. They demand that a seriously broken world deliver what it could never deliver, even if it were not broken. Read that again. We demand, and advertisers demand, that a seriously broken world deliver what it could never deliver, even if it were not broken. They fail to recognize that at the bottom of all of this drivenness and insanity is an expectation that now can be the paradise it will never be. Do you feel that? Do you feel that, Paul? I sure do. And God is gracious to us, very gracious to us, to let us see the brokenness of the stuff and the people and the things that our hearts so easily bank on for finding that little relief now, when we were always designed for the second coming. Titus 2:11 through 13 says, "The grace of God," let me just take this off the screen here. "The grace of God has appeared," first coming, "bringing salvation for all people, teaching us to live out our lives in a certain way." It says teaching us to deny ungodliness and worldly passions and to live upright, godly lives in this present age. And then there's a comma in the English text. And the next phrase is a phrase that we know. But my question is, how often does it characterize your life and my life? So I'm going to read it again. "For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, teaching us to deny ungodliness and worldly loves, worldly lusts or passions, but to live upright, godly, sober lives in this present world, waiting for the blessed hope, the glorious appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ." Paul's saying that the life of a believer is characterized and hemmed in by both Advents. The grace appears, Advent 1, the celebration of the incarnation, and that transforms the way we live, but it's not divorced from this future passionate waiting for, looking forward to, the blessed hope. What is one of the best imaginable things that you can imagine happening to you in the next 6 months? Does that include the glorious appearing of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ? How often does that actually factor into what you practically and what I practically am looking forward to? Rather, for us, we're looking forward to 7 days from now, right? The opening of the gift. And that's not to diminish that. But how often do we get caught up, as Paul says in Colossians, the shadows, and mistake the shadow for the substance, who is Christ? Today our text is found in Hebrews chapter 11. It was in our order of worship this morning, but I encourage you to turn there with me. Hebrews chapter 11. We want to focus in on this man Moses for a few moments together this morning, because there is good news this morning for individuals like me, and I think like you, whose hearts are quick to get sucked into the vortex of here and now. The title of today's sermon is called "The Power of Something Better." All those things we just showed you on the screen, they were offering you something better than the last version. And yet, today in this text, something else better is offered, which allowed and enabled this man Moses to do something very, very countercultural. Let's read it. Chapter 11, verses 24 and following. "By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible." This morning, I'd like for us to look at this gaze this stance of Moses, that he was looking to this reward. He saw, verse 27, him who was invisible. But what did that actually do? Because this is the power of Advent. This is the power of the second Advent, brothers and sisters. And we need power against the onslaught of marketing messages and cravings from within and cravings of our culture. We need power to be able to do something in light of all those messages saying, you're lacking, get. And to convince our hearts that we can wait. Convince our hearts that we can do without. The power of the second coming, the power of this better reward. He was looking to the reward. He was looking to the one who is invisible. I want to share with you, what did it have the power to do? The first, the power of this reward, the power, number one, was it gave him the power, verse 24, to refuse a very powerful or very acceptable cultural identity. Look at this with me. By faith, verse 24, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. We know the story. Pharaoh, you look in Acts 7, you can get this. You can look in Exodus 2 and get this. But Pharaoh's daughter, of course, comes down to the river, finds baby Moses. He is weaned, he's raised, and then he's raised for all these years in Pharaoh's house. And Stephen's sermon in Acts chapter 7 tells us what? That at age 40, a big choice came for Moses. He looked out and saw his people being ill-treated. And it was in his heart, God put it in his heart, to go out from where he was to be with his people, because God had put in his heart already that he was going to help restore and rescue them. Now, that looks, if you read Acts 7, like a simple, oh, God put in his heart at age 40 that his people, his kinsmen, were out, they were suffering, and he goes out to them. That was a big jump. That was a big step for Moses. Why? Well, just take a look here. I want to share with you, refusing this identity that was both his naturally, because he was adopted by the daughter of Pharaoh, it gave him access to the most powerful empire in the world and all of its riches. Look at this right here, just from a standpoint. This is the, very possibly, King Thutmose I was the Pharaoh we're dealing with here. And his daughter, this is not for sure, but very plausible that his daughter, which her name is Hatshepsut, was the daughter that we're referring to. He refused to be called the son of this woman. She, being the one who likely could have adopted him, she was unusual in that she was one of the very few female pharaohs in Egypt, a very powerful woman. And scholars believe that most likely she, because Moses was this adopted son, he was in line to become pharaoh. She built this huge temple, which today is still able to be visited and seen, the temple of Hatshepsut. So we're talking about a woman and a status given to Moses for the first 40 years of his life that gave him access and identity. It built him up. It gave him status. He did not lack in anything. Anything he wanted to have, he could have. And yet, what did he do? He turned his back. He refused. The power of the reward gave him the power to refuse being called and being defined by what his culture gave him as the adopted son and what was available to him. We're going to come back and look specifically at how that actually plays out in our world. But let's go to number two. What's the second thing that the advent of Jesus, the second advent of Jesus, this coming reward gives us the power? It gave him not only the power to refuse, but it gave him the power to choose. choose rather, verse 25, to be mistreated with God's people than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. The reward, and we know from these two verses, verse 25 and 6, that the reward clearly was seeing him who was invisible. It's very directly related to Jesus, the pre-incarnate Jesus at this time. But this reward enabled him to identify not with his culture. He refused his culture, but he chooses rather to side with a completely different identity. It's an identity that is defined by God. It says he chose to be mistreated with the people that God set apart, that God defined, that God called out. Think about this. He's in line to be Pharaoh. He has access to everything. There's nothing withheld from him. And yet, something is so powerful in his mind that it causes all this stuff that he could have, and wealth and knowledge. He's got it all. He was trained in Egypt. He says, I'd rather side with people that are defined by God and God's love and actually suffer ill treatment or mistreatment with them. He was looking to the reward, and that reward enabled him to choose God's people over his culture. Number three, the reward gave him the power to consider the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. You see, he made a choice, but we're kind of driving down. The author of Hebrews is driving down into the thought pattern of Moses right here, saying what was going on in his heart. He was considering that reproach of Christ, the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. Now, what's going on here? Because is Moses actually thinking, thousands of years before Hebrews is written, is Moses actually thinking the reproach of Jesus is greater than all the stuff I've got? Possibly, yes. I have no doubt that the Spirit of God can do that. We do know that he said very clearly, God said to him, Yahweh said to him, I will send a prophet to you. I will raise up this man and you shall listen to him. There was this coming for a prophecy of this coming speaker, this prophet that was given to Moses. So we very clearly know from Moses' time that God was giving him promises of the coming Messiah. Now, but why this phrase, the reproach of Christ? Well, the context of Hebrews is what? Hebrews is written to individuals, Christians, Jewish Christians, who had come out of Judaism and who were tempted to say, you know what? The system is safer. Go back in. It's stable. Letting go of Jesus and re-embracing the Mosaic way, that is safe. Holding on to Jesus causes great loss, great suffering. And the whole book of Hebrews is saying, don't let go of your hope. Don't let go of Jesus. Share in the reproach of Christ. And so he's actually pulling in these terms of the Messiah who has come to this audience and connecting it with Moses, saying, Moses was doing the same thing. He was saying, this coming promised Messiah is the one I'm siding with, and that's going to even cause me to suffer something because I'm aligning myself with him. Temporal loss, but this confidence of eternal gain. He refused by the power of this reward. He chose deciding with God's people. He considered, he was enabled to consider the reproach of Christ greater wealth than all of Egypt. And then verse 27, number 4. By faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. The power of the reward, the power of the second advent, the power of this one who is invisible, is that it gives you the power and not fear man. Because it's like this. It gives us the power to not be enchanted by the praise of men. Recently, John Piper wrote about how must we prepare room for the Messiah. He said, we're going to prepare room for him. We must become disenchanted with, he said several things, but two of them were, we must become disenchanted with the ability of things and stuff to satisfy the soul. We also must become disenchanted with the praise of men. All the stuff that we just put on the screen there, in one way, if you get that, you've set yourself apart and you've enabled or increased the potential for men and women and children to admire you, to respect you, because cultures do that. Cultures respect advanced technology, the latest and the greatest, the new and the improved. And if you get it, whether you actually are saying this directly or not to yourself, our hearts naturally were born desiring the praise of men. But do you see that the power that is in this promised reward, this promised invisible one who is able to be seen, is that it enables a man to not be afraid of the displeasure of the highest man in his culture and anybody else in that culture. So this begs the question, what is it about this reward that gives it the power to do this? So if it does these four things, what is it about it? How does it do that? Well, our text starts by telling us in verse 26, there's one very key word here that is used to contrast what Moses chose and what was available to him. It's an adjective. It's talking about the pleasures and the treasures. It describes the pleasures and the treasures of Egypt. What is that word? Look at your text. What is the word that describes the pleasure and treasure of Egypt? Since this is not too large of an audience, you can speak out. What is it? Fleeting. Fleeting. Passing. Transient. Gonna break. Gonna get cracked. Gonna get scratched. Not gonna satisfy. This year we had a big change in our life. For the past 4 years, we've been working as a family without a vehicle in China, and God supplied us with a vehicle, and it was an amazing change. It's a game changer for us, like being able to drive the family and not get buzzed around and near colliding with taxis and stuff. Like, when you're riding in taxis in China, it can be pretty harrowing. I think Brad can probably give you some firsthand accounts of that. But our car, which is this minivan that Mazda makes, was a new car. Our friends told us, don't buy used in China. The used market's just not sure what you're going to get. So I got this new thing. So proud, because my friend, this other mission worker, said, you know, in the first 6 days, it's going to get scratched. It's going to get hit. Just recognize it's just going to happen. So I made it for the first 6 days. No dings, no scratches. Made it 6 months, and I was so proud of myself. I was like, I'm pretty good. I'm a pretty good driver. Until the day I was pulling out of my apartment, kind of like a subdivision. It's just high-rise apartments. Going about 2 miles an hour. If I could have had a wreck, it would have been good to have like a really good wreck, right? Going 2 miles an hour, and in China, if there's an empty spot on the road, you better feel it. Like, you can't wait to let somebody, like, you've got to get it. And so there was a space. I was going to turn left, and a guy was coming, but there was enough room. He was coming pretty fast. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do what Chinese do. You fill the space, and they slow down for you. Traffic in China is like total fluidity. Lines mean nothing. It's just all over the place. You just have to be ready to move with the whole thing. So I did what I thought I had always been doing for 6 months, and it didn't work, and we hit. And I was immediately struck with, you know, oh my goodness, this is this car that like people in America have supplied for us and like have God has provided, and this thing is busted. The front end is all messed up. Okay. It was just an example of how my heart so quickly was taking that and forgetting. It's stuff. It's fleeting. It's going to break. But you see, Moses had some understanding of this because he was looking at his culture as great as it was, but the pleasures and the treasures still were fleeting. That's the first way this reward is contrasted, because if you flip your page over to chapter 10 of Hebrews, we had this as our meditation this morning. Look in chapter 10. We had our meditation starting with verse 35, but back up from there and look at verse 32, chapter 10 of Hebrews, verse 32. But recall the former days when after you were enlightened, brothers and sisters, you endured a hard struggle with suffering, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has great reward. Why? Because the possession is abiding. It's not fleeting. The power of this reward is that it abides. It is not fleeting. Look at verse 37 of chapter 10. Because this is where it gets very personal, with the very first person mouth words of God saying, yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not delay. The coming one. It's not just the coming streets of gold. It's the coming one will not delay. He is the reward. So we've seen these four areas that in the life of Moses, he was given power because of this coming one, because of this one who is abiding, not fleeting, to refuse his own culture or identified by his culture. He didn't refuse his culture. He lived him. He was refusing to be identified by it. To choose to side with God's people, to consider the greater wealth to be embracing hardship with Jesus or with Jesus' people, and then gave him the power to let go of needing the praise of men. But if you turn over to Numbers chapter 20, which I don't want you to do right now, Numbers chapter 20 tells us about the day when Moses was at the waters of Meribah. Remember what happened there? God says, I want you to speak to the rock, and I will cause waters to gush out, because the people have been complaining. Moses comes up to the rock with the staff, and he talks. He says, okay, you rebels. He's like, you want water? You're going to get water. Strikes the rock twice. Water comes out. Deuteronomy chapter 32, at the very end of Moses' life, he's up on the mountain looking into the promised land, and God reminds him of that day. He says, you didn't treat me as holy that day. You didn't treat me as uncommon. You treated me like one of your own. And you actually, you hit the rock. You didn't believe me. But the way he says it there in chapter 32 of Deuteronomy and chapter 20 of Numbers is, you didn't regard me as holy. Why do I bring this up here? I bring this up because as good as Moses was, Moses is not included in chapter 11 of Hebrews for us to make this case study our model. This is telling us, Hebrews chapter 11 is telling us what a life of faith does. How faith actually plays itself out. Faith does not enable you and me to have all of the culture we're in and all of Jesus. It requires a break. But Moses didn't break perfectly. Because there is the second Moses who is going to come, the coming one. And the second Moses is the one who, when he was tempted in the wilderness for 40 days and nights, he said this. The temptation was, "You're lacking, you're hungry, get bread. Make bread from these stones." And he said what? "My immediate needs are not ultimate. My immediate cravings are not ultimate. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." When he was doing that, brothers and sisters, he was refusing an identity defined by his culture and his cravings right then. He was choosing the path of suffering, the path of less, to earn salvation for you. Fast forward, Paul's account, 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 9, "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich." Another outplaying of this second Moses greater figure. He had everything. Though he was rich, yet he became poor. He came across the tracks. So that you and I, through his poverty, might be brought in this morning, might be made rich. You see, brothers and sisters, as was already prayed, I think, by John this morning, or spoken by John, there was joy set before Jesus. There was joy. He saw many sons that were going to come to glory. He saw you. And so he said, "I'm going to get out. I'm going to go. For the glory of my Father, I'm not going to remain in his culture." And he exited. He exited the heavenly kingdom and he became man. For the joy he set before him, he endured the cross. And the cross was he endured the shame and the blame that we deserve to carry on our backs for our rebellion. He endured it willingly and gladly and is seated at the right hand of God. So the Hebrews, as they're getting tempted every day to let go of Jesus, their author to the Hebrews is writing, he's saying, there's a better and abiding possession. To lay hold of it requires faith. Faith requires refusing, choosing, considering, and not fearing. And it's only fueled by seeing the one who is invisible, the greater reward, and that's the one who has come, the greater Moses, and he is the one who laid aside his wealth to embrace you and me. Therefore, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that so easily besets us and run with patience the race that is set before us. Brothers and sisters, waiting is empowered by this coming one who says, "I will come and will not delay." Okay, so what? That's all good. But what might this refusing one identity and choosing the blessed hope practically look like? A few ideas. Number one, as we live in light of this,
living in this faith. It will look like being viewed. It will look like being viewed as weird in exchange for walking by faith and siding with Jesus and his people. If you're going to side with Jesus and his people, you will be weird in our culture, and we have to become okay with that. For you teenagers in this room, it will mean standing up for a Christian brother or sister when it puts your reputation on the line. It's going to mean being okay with not being up to date fashion-wise in order to put your hope in heaven. It's going to mean coming alongside of widows and orphans, siding with the people that God sides with, ministering to single parents. It's going to redefine the way we translate fear of missing out. Instead, it's not so much the latest Twitter feed or the latest CNN headline that we're afraid we don't get. Instead, it means fear of missing out on God, what God is doing, God's mission. Not fear of missing out on the latest trend or gadget or day after Christmas sale. It's okay if we don't shop on the day after Christmas. It's really okay. It may mean taking some time that you go to the mall and get one more gift, and instead spend that time with somebody in this church who is in need of comfort, encouragement, and deliverance. It means that we make a big deal about the people of God, the people that God defines, the church, the gospel, the weightier matters of the law, and not what our culture is making a big deal of. It may simply mean, brothers and sisters, that we refuse to keep living life like everything's okay, and opening up for the first time, or in a long time, with a brother or sister, a spouse, a friend, about something you're struggling with, and begin receiving the love and the forgiveness and the healing and the non-fleeting hope from God and his people. Because there is a reward for those who seek him. It means tenaciously clinging to Psalm 81:16. Psalm 81 is a beautiful psalm. I'd commend it to your reading this week. God says, "Oh, that my people would listen to me. I would have satisfied them with the finest of wheat, and with honey from the rock, I would have satisfied them." He's saying, he's pulling his images out of the Old Testament. He's pulling images of honey. Honey is the land of Canaan. Rock is what? Rock is wilderness. He's putting those two together. I would satisfy my people in the most unexpected of places and ways, even in their own wilderness. I would satisfy them, but they would not listen to me. Brothers and sisters, that's what it comes down to on a practical level every day. Is God able to meet my every need, even the need for a new set of clothes? Or is that totally up to you? I've actually been convicted because as we have to go back to China, it's a lot easier to get some things here for sure and cheaper than it is in China, if you can believe that. Yeah, they make everything, but still it's more expensive to get it there and yada yada. So, Rachel and I have been talking. It is so frustrating to just have to like keep on getting online and getting some new this and new that. And like I've been so convicted, like, how often am I actually seeking God in the purchasing of this stuff? Or am I just trying to get through it, check it off? Am I trying to satisfy this own desire to, oh, I need to get this new pair of shoes, yada, yada? Brothers and sisters, God would satisfy you with the finest of wheat and with the best in the midst of the worst. Some of you are in some pretty, pretty dark places right now. And that sounds totally foreign or impossible. But I'm telling you, it's the mouth of God, and God does not lie. Test him. Try him. See if you can go without what you think you need a little longer and let him enter and satisfy you. The beauty and the glory and permanence of Jesus' coming, his second coming, this blessed hope, as Titus says, gives us the power to let go of having our best life now. Full of our culture's comforts and conveniences, full of access to our culture's pleasures and treasures, it enables us to cross cultures. It enables us to embrace hardship with God's people as we wait for the reward, seeing Him who is invisible. So we need grace today. Because this is the fight of faith. This ain't no cakewalk. This is a get down and dirty fight every single hour. You feel it? I feel it. But there's great, great power and grace given to cross some of the biggest jumps. Giving you the power to not have to have what your culture and your cravings tell you you've got to have. It's in Him. It's in Jesus. I want to just close with a recent, not too recent, but a fairly recent blog post on the meaning of Advent. Even on this side of Good Friday, this side being, we're on this side of the cross and the Resurrection Sunday, there is brokenness in our world no cart full of Black Friday bargains can fix. There is hunger in our souls that no plate full of pumpkin custard can fill. There is twistedness in our hearts no terrestrial hand can touch. The whole creation, the Apostle Paul declared, has been groaning together for redemption, Romans 8:22. In Advent, Christians embrace the groaning, recognizing it is not as hopeless whimpering. It's not groaning that is hopeless whimpering over the paucity of the present moment, but as expectant yearning for the divine banquet Jesus is preparing for us. In Advent, the church admits, as poet R.S. Thomas puts it, that the meaning is in the waiting. And what we await is a final advent yet to come. Just as the ancient Israelites awaited the coming of the Messiah in flesh, we await the coming of the Messiah in glory. In Advent, believers confess that the infant who drew his first ragged breath between a virgin's knees has yet to speak his final word. Has yet to speak his final word. That word is full of grace and full of power for us today to let go of the voices and the pleasures and treasures around us and hope for something better. May God give you, Emmanuel, great power to be pilgrims and strangers in this city, shining as brilliant lights. And may He give us power in China to do the same. We love you. God loves you.